For me, one of the things that rituals do is they take us out of that world, that they make these things that can become automatic, almost like an automaton. And when we do them again and again, it can make us even more of an automaton. But when we repeat rituals, we actually add meaning to them. So the more we do them, the more rich they become for us, whether it's silly morning routines like we talked about, or things you do with your family, or things you do with your children, or your significant other. All of these kinds of repeated behaviors that we engage in, they move us from just the behaviors themselves to something, I think, again, richer. And I think when we look back on life, sometimes it's the rituals that we've engaged in that are the most memorable things that happened in our lives. The weddings, the birthdays, the holidays, even things like funerals on the sadder end of rituals. These are the kinds of experiences that really are very emotional and very meaningful for us. And so they do sort of accumulate over time into a more interesting life that we look back on and say, oh, I'm really glad that I had that.
That nugget of wisdom was from Dr. Michael Norton. Now, if you're not familiar with Dr. Norton's work, he is an HBS, a Harvard Business School professor, a psychologist who researches rituals. Now, when I first got wind of Dr. Mike's work, I was like, ooh, I'm interested in rituals, in large part because I'm interested in habits. What I came to find out through reading this great new book that we're going to talk about in today's show, Dr. Mike's new book called The Ritual Effect, is, well, it's many things. Habits are things that you need to get done. Rituals, they help with meaning. And my goal as in this human life is to have a rich, meaningful life. And I started putting together, I didn't think I really had rituals, and I started looking very closely at this, and it just made my world that much more interesting. And also, I saw a bunch of opportunities to add meaning where maybe I wasn't capitalizing on that before. A fascinating and very fun, far-ranging conversation. I confess a few of my super weird rituals and ones that I share with my family, for example, as does Dr. Mike. And I think it's going to put an interesting lens on the rituals that you have in your life, especially those creators out there, creators and entrepreneurs. The process that we go through prior to creating, turns out that matters and helps a lot. So please enjoy yours truly, Dr. Michael Norton, on The Ritual Effect. Mike, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being a guest.
Chase, it's awesome to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I always enjoy starting out. I will have just shared with the listeners and watchers a little bio, a little about you, but I always prefer to get that in your own voice rather than mine. It's like 50% better every time. So I wanted to invite you to give a little bit of backstory on you, your career, how you sort of want to show up in the world and in today's conversation.
Yeah, I'm actually a psychologist by training, but not the useful kind. So not the kind that helps people with their problems and things like that. I'm the kind that does research on humans, sort of trying to figure out what makes us tick. And I got interested in all kinds of stuff like happiness and well-being and all these kinds of ways that humans are kind of trying to cope with problems in life and improve our lives. And at some point I got on this idea of rituals as being a thing that humans seem to turn to in all these different domains of life. So I've studied them in all these different domains. I'm a professor at Harvard Business School. So partly I study them in the domain of work and how, you know, we use them to separate work life from home life and how we use them in our teams. But for me, really, the topic is everywhere I look, I keep seeing kind of like I've lost my mind a little bit. I keep seeing rituals everywhere. And that's why it's so fun to talk about with people to see what their experience is as well.
Love it. I will open up our conversation today with if a ritual is something you do all the time, like maybe you could define it. How is it different from a habit? What are the sort of components that define a ritual relative to something we do most of the time, or like the habit we have of checking our phone? Or what's the difference between a ritual and a habit? And then again, I'll turn a card over that I have been thinking about, but I'd like to hear your definition early on here.
I think that habits are, by the way, I'm not anti-habit, just to be very clear. I think we all need
better
habits.
You're a habit hater. What are you?
Exactly. Like, I should have better habits. Everyone should have better, you know, eat healthy and all this stuff. So I never mean rituals are better than habits. Mm-hmm. Our habits aren't any good. Just I think rituals are a little different and kind of add a little bit more richness to life. So for me, habits are kind of what we do. You know, we have to do these things to get them done. Like, my favorite example is whether people shower first and then brush their teeth in the morning, or brush their teeth and then shower in the morning. And about, I just taught a class this morning, about half of humans do it each way. There's no consensus on whether you should shower or brush then shower. But those are kind of like habit. You know, I mean, we're going to do them every morning. We do them to get them done. Not a big deal. Nothing too emotional or interesting about it. But the question then is, imagine I asked, and think of which type of person you are, but imagine I asked you to flip the order. So if you always brush your teeth and then you hop in the shower, imagine tomorrow I said, nope, got to do it the other way. You got to shower first and then brush your teeth. About half of people say, fine, like, I don't, you know, whatever, it's fine with me. But about half of people say, no, I don't want to. And I say, well, why not? And they say, I don't know, but I would feel weird. I would feel off. I wouldn't feel ready for my day. And that's when it's moving from kind of a habit, kind of a dry, got to get this stuff done just to get it done, toward not a ritual like people in robes chanting with candles, not that far down the continuum, but a little bit more emotional. We care about the order in which we do things. It matters to us. There's emotion in it. There's some meaning in it. Like, it helps us feel ready for our day. That's when things start to get a little bit more ritualistic. They have these properties that go beyond boring mundane and turn boring mundane things into something, I think, that's a little richer.
Mm. Great. That is a beautiful way of setting the table for this. You know, again, thank you for getting me an early copy of the book. It's not out here for, we record these things a month early or so. So again, we'll drop this. When people are listening, you can buy the book. It's called The Ritual Effect. One of the things that I thought about is the concept of, you know, the everydayness of many of these things. And someone recently, it was an unrelated conversation, but someone is like, you know, you really need to pay attention to the things that you do every day, because the compounding effects of doing something every day, it cuts both ways. You can see how it would affect you if you did 50 pushups every day. Wow, that's really great. But it was in the context of, what are we putting on our body, our skins, in our mouth, our teeth? Fluoride used to be great. Now fluoride's terrible. And all of the soaps and, you know, and I'm like, oh, that's really fascinating. I've never thought about the things that I could do that are potentially harmful, the compounding, stacking, negative effects of those things. So I'm wondering if you can talk to us about the flip side of that. Is that why you decided to study rituals? Is it because it turns out that these things that we do on small, regular basis, they dramatically affect our lives? Or is this just a nice to have, and it's an interesting thing to know a little bit more about? Like, what was your rationale for studying?
I think that, again, I'm not going to be anti-habit, I promise. But I do think that, you know, this whole industry is devoted to helping us have better habits. And the idea is, you want to do something that's good for you. You want to do it every day or every hour or whatever it might be. And so you try to do it enough that it becomes automatic, almost mindless. You know, you want to just get out of bed and put your running shoes on and go for a run and not struggle with it. You want to just go and do it. And that's amazing. I mean, we all should exercise again and eat healthy and things like that. But if I think about a life where you always execute all of your desired habits perfectly. So imagine for 30 years, you never ever slipped up even one time with your habits. You always got up at 6 a.m. You always went for this run. You always ate the exact same healthy food every single day. You look back after 30 years, I'm not sure you would say, you would be healthy, but I'm not sure you would say, what an interesting, rich, and wonderful life I've had, as opposed to, I think I was kind of like a robot. And so for me, one of the things that rituals do is they take us out of that world, that they make these things that can become automatic, almost like an automaton. And when we do them again and again, it can make us even more of an automaton. But when we repeat rituals, we actually add meaning to them. So the more we do them, the more rich they become for us, whether it's silly morning routines like we talked about, or things you do with your family, or things you do with your children or your significant other, all of these kinds of repeated behaviors that we engage in, they move us from just the behaviors themselves to something, I think, again, richer. And I think when we look back on life, sometimes it's the rituals that we've engaged in that are the most memorable things that happened in our lives. The weddings, the birthdays, the holidays, even things like funerals on the sadder end of rituals. These are the kinds of experiences that really are very emotional and very meaningful for us. And so they do sort of accumulate over time into a more, I think, a more interesting life that we look back on and say, oh, I'm really glad that I had that.
Help us then distinguish, should we look at the lens of our lives only through rituals? Should everything have meaning?
Sometimes we just have to get stuff done. So I think for sure, there's tasks, you know, we got to pay our taxes. You could, I suppose, create
the ritual of taxes. I mean, sadly, it is a ritual. Yes. It's a pain.
We have a specific day every year that, you know, the emotion comes and the stress comes. We don't typically on days like that create like a national rich, like Thanksgiving. We don't have foods associated with tax day and things like that. So there are things that you just got to get it done. And I'm not sure that adding ritual is the way to go. But I do think we have lots of opportunities in our everyday lives to experiment with and play with ritual a little bit more. One of my favorite examples, it's so simple, but we did some research on rituals in couples and romantic couples. And this one couple, when we asked them, you know, what do you do with your partner? You know, do you have anything special that you do? And this one couple said, well, you know, I don't know when it started exactly, but every time before we eat, we clink our forks together 3 times. Which is, a fork is extremely boring. You know, eating is, you got to put food in your mouth. We need food. But they've turned a fork and eating into this lovely little connection that they have between the two of them. So rituals, they don't have to be, you know, 5 hours of meditation kind of ritual. I think of them as these little repeated behaviors that really are boring. On the one hand, it's just a fork. But on the other hand, when we build meaning into them, we can get a lot more out of every single meal we have because it comes not just eating food, but connecting with our loved ones.
Very well said. The obvious follow-on here is then, how do we make meaning from something that historically we have thought of as meaningless? You talked about, you can either shovel food into your face with whatever device is near, or there's this beautiful sort of a ceremony, and I would say the making of meaning that couple, for example, has chosen to do. Is it as easy as that? What's the research say? What's your lens on making meaning?
You know, it's funny because if you ask people, do you engage in any rituals, you know, in your life? People say, no, I'm not a new agey person. You know, I don't engage in rituals, anything like that. But then if I ask a question like, on your birthday, has anybody ever made you a cake and then put candles in the cake and then lit the candles on fire on top of the cake, then walked around with the cake while it's on fire, singing a terrible song that you can't even understand the words to. Then you close your eyes, make a wish, blow out the candles, getting wax all over the cake. People say, oh yeah, no, of course I've done that. And I say, well, let's just unpack what we're doing there. You know what I mean? It's an insane thing to get wax all over something you're going to eat. But we've decided.
And then blow on it, right?
Crazy,
and blow
right? On it. I mean, it's insane. With little kids, it's like everybody's getting sick all the time. You know, I mean, we do these things and you think, my gosh, if I really break it down, what an unusual thing we've decided to do. But we're able to, as humans, actually imbue things like a cake and candles and blowing candles out with a lot of meaning. And I think it's actually quite lucky that we're able to do that. You know, you could think about, you need to have extraordinary things happen in your life to have really meaningful experiences. But we've got this little thing that we have where we can turn the silliest little thing. I mean, athletes, the way they tie their shoes, they turn tying their shoes, which is a very boring thing to do, into something that actually makes them feel prepared for whatever they're going to do next. And I think this really is a lot of opportunity for ritual, because I think sometimes the word conjures up the people in robes with candles, 1,000-year-old tradition kind of thing. And those are for sure rituals, and they could be very meaningful for people. But I got really interested in the kind that people are just kind of freelancing all the time on their own, creating these little moments of meaning and emotion for themselves.
Mm. I was fascinated in the book, the differentiation between rituals that we do for ourselves, like the ones that you just mentioned with the athletes, and then the, say, the birthday or the holidays, and how dramatically different those two things are. And yet you found a way to sort of nest them in a tidy fashion, both under this sort of new moniker and I think insightful one about rituals. What's the difference? Is there, are they equally valuable? Help us think about
that. Yeah, I think the crazy thing about the versatility of rituals in general is, you know, we use them at weddings, and then we also use them at funerals, which is strange, right? They're very different occasions in life, and yet we turn to the same kinds of ceremony. And even things like sometimes we use rituals to amp ourselves up, like before a big game with our team. And sometimes we use rituals to try to calm ourselves down. So we have these completely opposing needs and goals that we're trying to get done in life, amp up, calm down, grieve, celebrate. And with all of them, we're pulling ritual into the, we do other things, of course, as well, but we pull ritual into the mix on these things to try to create something different and make ourselves feel a bit differently. And some of our research, as you said, is on the people doing it themselves. We can talk about people's pre-performance rituals that they often do, like going to the bathroom and yell at yourself in the mirror, you know, you're ready for this, you got this. So some of them are very private, but then very same thing can be used in a group. So in our teams, for example, we'll also have rituals before a big game or before a big performance. So we have this ability to go from really us on our own to our romantic couples, to our families, to our organizations. And then obviously at the cultural level, different countries and different religions have their own specific rituals that they've agreed on. So for me, it's just so interesting that we use them. You can imagine this is a thing that people only use by themselves. Or, yeah, those are those things that, you know, countries and religions develop. And instead, it's at every level of analysis, you're kind of saying, yeah, we use them there, we use them there, we use them there, we use them there. And that opens it up as a topic because you really start to see it everywhere.
Yeah, that's, you know, the thing. One of the things I love about my job is I get to read a ton. I read a bunch of really smart people like yourself, your work. And it's as soon as you, and anytime I'm deep in a book, I'm like, you can't unsee rituals. I'll just give you one example. And it has to do with something that is historically rather benign. My wife and I, whoever brushes their teeth first, whoever like is first in the bathroom, makes a toothbrush for the other person. Simple as just putting,
love it.
And yeah. And I do not know. I know that I started it because we have talked about this since reading your book. And she said, yeah, I remember you started doing that. And I thought it was the sweetest thing. And then so there's this reciprocity. Now, you know, we've been together for a very long time. So then she started doing that. And then it turned into whoever. And we have shared that with some other friends in, you know, just as you do. Like, oh, what's a cute thing that, you know, that Chase does for Kate or whatever. And it turns this thing, which has historically one of the most benign, you open today's show, right, with like as simple as brushing your teeth.
Exactly.
And yet it's a little, we have chosen to assign meaning to that thing. And this is like a little head nod, a little gift, if you will. So is this the vehicle? Is ritual the vehicle for meaning?
First off, I love the example that you gave, because as you said, it's like, what's more boring than toothpaste? You know, you might think
totally
of wine and chocolates and stuff like that as a way to have a little ritual with your partner. Those would be good too. But the idea that you could use toothpaste, I think, is just amazing. And I also, it's funny because if you ask people, how would you feel if they forgot? Is another way to tell that you have a ritual, because you might say, yeah, you know, they bring me coffee every morning, but I don't really care, until the morning when they don't bring the coffee and you say, are you having an affair? You know, I mean, your mind goes all these different places. And the other one that I love is if you find out that the ritual that you thought was just for the two of you, if your partner used it with a previous partner, or you find out after you break up, they reuse it with somebody else. And I mean, the anger and the, you know, rage that if I hope you don't, but if you ever got divorced and you found out,
I can never make another toothpaste.
You know what I mean? You can never, ever, you just never go back on that. So, I mean, again, toothpaste on a toothbrush, and yet, gosh, they have so much meaning and they mean so much to us.
So if we start to think of that, would you advocate that this is in fact a way to add meaning to something that might otherwise be meaningless? Is this an opportunity to imbue, you use the word imbue, to be imbue like interest and joy and awareness? I'm a big awareness guy.
Yep.
I'm like, if you want to talk about habits, like it's very difficult to change habits if you're not aware of ones that you have or that you don't have and wish you did, yep. for example. So, you know, there's sort of an inculcation, there's like an intention that you're setting. And I'm curious if in your research, and maybe again, your own POV, like, is this just a beautiful way to make life richer? And if so, can we overdo it?
It's great. Both of those are great, great questions. I think I often encourage people to experiment a little bit. So some people say, I don't have any rituals, and then I make them do the birthday cake thing. But also, you know, different moments in life, we have different rituals. So people say, I don't do anything before I have a meeting at work. You know, I just walk right in. And then I say, well, anything before a first date? And they say, oh yeah, no, I have a whole thing I do before a first date. So we have these, you know, different moments for different ones of us that matter to us, and we bring ritual on board. And just because you have some ritual in the morning doesn't necessarily mean you have one, you know, at work. So we see a lot of variability across people in where they bring them to bear. But I think there, to your point, there is an opportunity to try them out and see how they go for you. You know, they may, it's not like if you do a ritual, your marriage is 50% better the moment after you do it. That's not how they work. But you can create these things that do create connection or create different emotions in you. So I do think they are a pretty cheap opportunity to try to add a little bit of joy, meaning, wonder, all these words that we care a lot about.
Mm-hmm. So on this show, we talk a lot about work, a lot about career, in part, I'll say because I looked to my own past and I was on somebody else's path before I found my own. And that provided both sort of a radical shift in my own mentality, my own sort of joy and well-being when I sort of found the thing that I was supposed to be doing and steered away from the thing that culture or whatever had pre-programmed me, or the, you know, we can talk about it as lightweight pressure, P with a lowercase p, for example, to do a certain thing. But when I found that, I became alive. So work has a big role in our show. And if you asked, I imagine if I polled the listeners, watchers of the show, do you want more meaning in your life? Yes, would be the answer. And I'm wondering if with our culture, you know, the topic of work being one that we explore a lot on the show, because it can be a source for joy and growth and development and interest. And we do spend so much time doing it. We have to provide for ourselves or our families or whatever. Is that the wrong place to be looking to impart meaning? Is ritual at work somehow less valuable or meaningful than rituals at home or with loved ones? I'm just wondering sort of where on, you talked about spectrums, yeah. And do you think of it as such, or are they separate universes? And if we're going for maximum awesome life, is it just as valuable to put meaning and ritual in work as it is home?
You know, one thing that's funny is we actually use rituals to separate work from home. So if you think about, you have your work self, which is a certain version of yourself, and then you have your home self, which is usually not quite the same person. But we have a hard, especially with working from home, as so many people are, we have a hard time separating. You know, how do you leave work behind if your office is 2 feet away from the kitchen table and your family's coming in for dinner right after you finish work? You know, how do we try to make sure that we keep work at work? And then we keep, you know, family and home time separate from that. And you can do all kinds of things. For one thing, if you used to have a commute, you have sort of a natural break between the two. But what we see people doing actually is they turn to rituals. So they think, if I'm going to divide my day into these two different selves, how should I do it? And we've interviewed lots and lots of people and asked them, what do you do? And people have the most fascinating ways of trying to leave whatever emotion they had at work behind and bring themselves up. Like we did a project with emergency room nurses, for example, who, which I think is, I don't have the data, but surely one of the most stressful jobs in the history of the world. Yeah. I mean, that is a really tough, very long shifts, very unpredictable, tons of things go wrong. So the question is, you know, if you're an emergency room nurse, how do you possibly do a 12-hour shift and then take 5 minutes and leave all of that behind and go home and be happy with your family? You know, it's a really, really big ask for us emotionally, just as humans.
Yeah.
And what so many of these emergency room nurses say is, well, I do. Here's what I do in between work and home. One of my favorite ones, this nurse said, when they got home, they would take a shower. And they would visualize, as the shower washed, they would visualize the hospital washing off of them and going down the drain. There's another person who did something similar and also drank a beer in the shower, which is, if you're into that, you could try that as well. Yeah. But like, on the one hand, you think, you know, you're not washing anything down the drain. You know, I mean, that, and on the other hand, you can feel how for this person, it really does help them separate all the stress of work, allow them to decompress and unwind so that they can be home and enjoy their home life as well. So even aside from meaning at home and meaning at work, we also use them to divide those two from each other and make sure that we can be who we want to be in each of those occasions.
I remember a part in the book about that you talked about dividing that. And I think this was a courageous piece of the book, because when you write a book, you know, I guess maybe as a Harvard Business School scientist, it's not as difficult, but I know I've written a couple and it's hard to really highlight something that could potentially fly in the face of your hypothesis that rituals are different than habits and add meaning and whatnot. And yet rituals divide us in many ways. I'm a member of this tribe. We have a certain set of rituals. You're a member of that tribe. You have a different set of rituals. So I see it, it makes it, it feels holistic and valuable in the context of a ER nurse that you want to, you know, my dad was a cop, for example. And I remember he would, he did an amazing job of not bringing work home.
Impressive.
Never talked about it. If I asked him about it, he would volunteer information, but it was only when pressed. And so it seems like that can be really a positive thing in that lens, my dad or the ER nurse. But what about this, like, I'm with my tribe and you're with your tribe and we have different, you know, different beliefs, different practices, different rituals.
Yeah, and we can show this in our research, in fact, that we can see that when we have even strangers get together, we have them do sometimes very silly rituals like clapping and stomping together at the same time. And I do this actually when I give talks as well. I make audiences do a ritual where they all do the same thing at the same time. People love it and they love each other. You know, we all just did this thing. We're all bonded together really well. So they're exactly, look at us go. And I mean, it's almost as like that. I can't believe we're doing this. And so that's really great. And, you know, you can think in organizations, what you might do with teams, you know, to sort of bond them together as well. And a simple message would be rituals are great. Just add them everywhere. And I think I'm very glad you raised this because, of course, like anything, they have rewards. And then they have risks and downsides as well. And we do see in our research that it's not just that our ritual is good and we're good. Mm-hmm. It's that our ritual is correct. And that can become a problem, because when my ritual is correct, it means if you do anything even slightly different, your ritual is incorrect. And when I have audiences engage in these rituals together, sometimes somebody, you know, everybody's clapping at the same time or stomping at the same time. Someone will make a mistake and clap at the wrong time. And it's like the room is so mad. You know what I mean? What's wrong with this guy? Get with the program. We're all doing this together. So even with these silly rituals that we make up, already we can see the roots of this. It's not just good, it's correct. And we do, therefore, judge other people harshly sometimes if they're not with the program that we're on.
Very, very helpful. So this is maybe a personal request. I've got a note here that I'm looking at as I was reading, and it's essentially a request for understanding and how to accept is the wrong word. The concept is around loss. And it's sort of like acknowledging, recognizing And I think there's loss maybe with a capital L, like someone passes away or we are no longer in a relationship. But I'm wondering about the value of rituals for small daily losses, like small daily failures, small daily, can we acknowledge that, we didn't show up as our best in that situation. We got upset at our kids, or we didn't show up in a way that we were, it made us proud at work or something like that. What does the research say? And again, I want to push you beyond the research and ask for, is there a prescription that you saw a pattern in the healthiest, most well-adjusted people around patterns, rituals with respect to failures and loss?
You know, one of the things that we see when we just, one of the things about rituals is you can just kind of survey different cultures and see how they grieve, for example, see how they cope with loss. And you see that really every culture has a way that is accepted, or every religion has a way that is accepted, with often a specific color of clothing. Sometimes it's white, sometimes it's black, sometimes it's red, sometimes it's green, but it's standard in whatever subculture you're in. There's music, there's very often candles and fire involved in grieving as well. So we have it in us, in a sense, with these big capital L losses, as you said, to find rituals to help us grieve collectively. And they do seem to be very meaningful for people. And you can think partly why is, you know, if, as many of us have, if you've ever experienced, you know, really intense grief from losing someone, one of the many negative things is that the grief is so acute and it feels that it will never subside. In other words, that you'll feel this bad forever because this loss is so overwhelming. And so how do we cope with an acute negative emotion like that? We can do all, you know, we seek out friends and family, we seek out professional help. Of course, there's many, many things that we do to cope with grief. But one of these things that these cultural rituals do us is they kind of almost tell us how we're doing. Because we do this funeral, which, you know, in different faiths, it lasts for a different number of days and different practices. But if people have been engaging in this ritual for hundreds of years or thousands of years, and it worked for them in the sense that they got through their grief, well, maybe if I do the same thing, I'm going to get through my grief as well. So they almost give us a sense that even things that seem completely unmanageable can be manageable. And that's really with these huge losses in our lives. But as you said, we also have these smaller losses. We've interviewed people, I was talking about if your wife ever reused the toothpaste thing, you know, with a new significant other. But we do see when people end relationships, they also engage in rituals to kind of put those behind them. Like very, very common. Now it's more delete the photos like off your Instagram page of your ex. But people used to tear them up and burn them. So we're, you know, tearing up and burning things is very ritualistic. We're trying to kind of leave the loss behind us and try to move on to feel a little bit better about the loss. So we've got, you know, the biggest losses in our lives. We've got our relationships. And then we also have these smaller losses that we have, you know, every day in life, in a sense. And we do see there as well that people will use rituals to try to get ready for something big. They'll often use rituals during the thing itself. And then after it's over, they'll often use rituals to try to recover as well. And that can be from like getting ready for the Super Bowl, you know, as a quarterback, to you and me having a meeting today and we're a little stressed about it and it doesn't go as well as we did. So we often actually see people scaffolding the whole stressful experience from before to during to after, thinking about ways to use rituals to help them through these really stressful times.
You open the book with a set of very interesting creative rituals and a couple really interesting ones. And I, you know, the show well, my audience identify as creative or entrepreneurial or curious about, you know, one or both of those things. You know, you've got this, the ritual, I guess, who is it? Was it Victor Hugo that hides his clothes?
Yes. He tells his valet.
There has his valet. Hide my clothes. I need to write and don't reveal to me where my clothes are. So I cannot go outside until I'm done writing for the day, as an example. And there's other ones with Charles Dickens, Agatha Christie. Let's see, here we are here in the book. And Maya Angelou, for example.
We have actually the cover of the book is a bathtub with an apple on it. And the number one question that I get is, what's the deal with the bathtub and the apple? It's kind of a strange image to have on any sort of book. But it is, in fact, Agatha Christie's. That's how she thought she came up with her ideas, was in the bath eating an apple. So very random sort of thing. But it just struck me as they're so common with creative people that you have some process that you go through in order to get yourself in the space where you can be creative. And I just couldn't resist using that one as the image because it's both so random and then also so relatable, you know, that we all have these little things that we do.
That is the essence of my question. Like, is that valuable for those folks who are listening, who identify as creative and creative curious or entrepreneurial, innovative, or desire to be? You know, how much of that helps the creative process, if at all?
If you ask, you know, creative people, what do you do before you get going? I don't know the exact percent because we didn't ask every single creative person in the world or a person who wants to be creative, but really, really a very high percent of people have something that they do in order to get ready to do the good creativity. Jeff Tweedy from Wilco has this thing where when he's starting to write music, the first thing he does is he pours out all the bad ideas. So he kind of does all the bad ideas and bad songs that are in him to get them out of the way so that he can maybe write a good song. And lots of creative people have something like that. Like, let me just do some garbage work first, just to get that out of the way. And then I can get going with the real creativity. And when you interview people, you know, it really does feel to them that it's very, very hard to get going when someone just says, go be creative today. It's a really, really hard thing to ask another human to do. If you say work on this PowerPoint presentation, you might not love working on it, but it's clear, you know, at least what you need to do with the slides. Go be creative is just such a daunting, stressful command to give ourselves or to get from somebody else. That it is, these are the situations where there's a lot of uncertainty and stress where we will turn to ritual to try to help us manage that stress and also then end up creating. And in fact, research shows that one of the things that rituals help us with is when we're lost in our head, which often can be, you know, I have to go do something and I'm worried about it. Why don't I just calm down? But I can't calm down. So now I'm even more anxious about what's happening. You know, we're in these loops of despair in our minds. Rituals break us out of it. They kind of allow us, they don't give us the bandwidth to keep the cycling, the doom spiraling, you know, in our heads. Because we're doing something else that takes us out of that. And we've done it many times. So it's a repeated practice. And just by quieting those thoughts a little bit, you can see how they could help you get in literally a better headspace to do the thing that you're really trying to do.
I love that. That is promising because I think of myself as someone who tasks myself with being creative almost every day. My rituals around it are, I would say, minimalized, and that's so I don't have to set myself up to do a bunch of stuff before I start. I don't want to have to start before I start. And yet, as soon as I find myself spinning out, there are a handful of things that I will run to. And it's sort of nice to know almost neurologically that those are the same. they're almost the same thing.
For sure. I noticed actually I'm going to say I'm a musician. That means that I play by myself in my basement, just to be clear. I wish I were a professional musician. But when I do try to write, after I started studying rituals, one of the things that I started noticing was my own, of course, because you can't just look at other people's, you got to examine yourself. And I find I have, and if there are other musicians as well, you'll have specific pieces of music that when you're stuck, you just start playing them. They just come out of you. And then you're done with them, and then you can go back to the thing. One of mine just randomly is Blackbird by the Beatles. I'm a guitarist, so I play that song.
Oh, I love that.
And it just kicks. And I realized, you know, I would be trying to write and be frustrated. And then it sort of come to me that I was playing that song. In other words, I didn't say, I should really play that right now. It will help me. We just develop these things that just come out of us. They become regular and repeated. And they do help us get a little bit unstuck.
Comfort. And that is largely, again, one of the reasons that I found the book so valuable is that it did help me think about the getting unstuck when in so many areas of our lives, whether they're creative at work or home, the sort of the nurturing and caring side that a ritual felt. The book is The Ritual Effect: From Habit to Ritual, Harness the Surprising Power of Everyday Actions. Last question for you before we let you go. What was the most unexpected thing that showed up in your research for this book?
This is going to be an incredibly self-centered answer, but it was actually, when I started studying rituals, I was doing like a, you know, I'm a Harvard scientist and, you know, I observe the humans engaged in their behaviors, et cetera, but not me. You know, I don't do rituals really. And I realized that I was studying for a few years with that kind of mindset a little bit. And I realized that the thing that happened to me basically was we had a daughter, our first daughter. And parents, if you have ever had a child, you know that when you bring a baby home, first off, it's like among the most stressful, shocking things, you know, that we can ever happen to. It's like, here's a human, good luck. But also the thing is sleep. They got to sleep. How do you get them to sleep? And what parents do is they turn completely instinctively, they turn to rituals. It's like this book and then this song. And then this parent does that, and this other parent does this, and then we need these three stuffed animals, and then we have this song right after that. I mean, really, really elaborate, like almost like written down in a holy book, you know, all of these steps. And what I realized, of course, after I was in it as a parent, I'm doing these two all the time. We had specific books, specific songs. We had specific stuffed animals. Like we had two bunny stuffed animals, a brown one and a gray one, and the gray one was the essential one. The brown one was a nice to have. The gray one was, you know, that, without gray bunny, everything's going to go. So, I mean, you really see, you know, in your own behaviors, just how much we turn to ritual to try to help us through these things. And for us, at least, I don't know if it helped her sleep, but it definitely helped us feel a little more control over the insane situation, because at least we had something that we could do to try to get it through these difficult times. So honestly, the self-centered answer, but it was actually not just, wow, these are ubiquitous all over the world. It was like, oh my God, these are ubiquitous in my own everyday life.
I love it. Thank you again so much for being a guest. Again, the book is The Ritual Effect. Very, very powerful. I love the distinction between adding meaning with rituals versus just habits, the things that we do. Thank you so much for writing it. It's available anywhere books are sold. Folks out there on the internet, you're going to love this one. Enjoy today's show. Again, I'm grateful to have had you on the show here, Dr. Mike. Thank you so much. And anywhere you'd steer people besides getting the book, The Ritual Effect, do you have a lab or a place you'd want a URL you want to steer us towards?
Actually, yeah. If you are interested in whether you, like me, have rituals all over your life already, you can just look up, if you look up Michael Norton Ritual Quiz, it'll come up. We have a quiz that you can take to see where you are on the continuum of all habits, no rituals, or all rituals, no habits.
And your TEDx talk, I have to steer people there too. That's awesome. How to Buy Happiness. Millions and millions of views on that one. Thank you so much again for being a guest. From Dr. Mike and myself, we both bid you an amazing day. Thanks for listening. All right. Hey, before you go, thanks so much for listening. And if you got value from this show, chances are your community will too, right? In the particular lies the universal. Please share this link to the show with a friend or mention the show on social. That is a huge benefit for us and hopefully in exchange for providing value to you. I want you to know that I really appreciate your time, the attention, anything that you give to the show, and the questions that you ask our guests, either on social media or through my text community. All that is pure gold. This community, like any community, is a testament to that old phrase, a rising tide floats all boats. And by elevating one another, by sharing and resharing this show, the tidbits that you learn and the experiences you take away, all of that has a collective, massive, positive impact on the world. So, just a quick thank you. I appreciate all the effort you put into sharing for this show. All right, that's a wrap. Let's put today's episode into practice and get back to growing together.